This is James W. Cooper. Today's date is December 12, 1973. The time is 7:30 p.m. I will be interviewing Mr. Donald Culver of Saginaw, Michigan. The topics to be discussed are lumbering and pharmacy. This is James W. Cooper. Today's date is December 12, 1973. The time is 7:30 p.m. I will be interviewing Donald Culver of Saginaw, Michigan. Topics to be discussed are lumbering and pharmacy. This is James W. Cooper. Today's date is December 12, 1973. The time is 7:30 p.m. I will be interviewing Donald Culver of Saginaw, Michigan. Topics to be discussed are lumbering and pharmacy.
Mr. Culver,
very formal.
Mr. Culver, would you relate some of your experiences that you had when you were in the state of Washington lumbering?
I think the most memorable experience, the most rewarding experience I ever had was working in the lumber camp 120 miles from Seattle. Ted Morley and I left in July, the very first of July, and picked up John Stewart in Chicago. We took the Milwaukee Road out to Seattle, and from there we took the train to Aberdeen, Washington, which was the headquarters of the Saginaw Timber Company, which was a Morley interest, and A.J. Morley ran the timber company out there. The bunkhouses were filled with cockroaches and lice and stuff like that. So they put us in the company hospital out there. We had a nurse out there, Mrs. Goodnow, and she looked after us like we were her own kids. The first day out there, we stayed at Camp 1, but we worked out at Camp 4, which was one of their camps. We went out on a logging train out there. I don't know how many miles it was, not too many miles, and my first job out there was splitting for a roading donkey. That is a donkey engine that hooks onto the logs and pulls them down a sluiceway, probably 300 or 400 yards. And from there, they are dropped off. There's a loading donkey up on a hill there. The loading donkey hooks onto these logs, which were 8 foot through, most of them, and 40 feet long. And then they were chained down there and let down the incline. Well, the first day, we went to work at 7 o'clock in the morning after breakfast. The alarm went off at the locomotive whistle blew at 5:30 in the morning. You just raised out of bed about 4 feet, had breakfast, and got on the train and went out to Camp 4. Well, started work at 7 o'clock in the morning, and boys, I used a 10-pound sledge and a bunch of wedges. They'd saw off a trunk of a tree and set it up on end, and you'd split it and make it in pieces of wood about the size of a railroad tie. Well, I worked very diligently, and long about, I didn't know what time it was, and some fella hollered my name, Culver, and I turned around. All the fellas was on the flat car ready to go back to Camp 1 to eat their dinner. And I turned around and says, "What? Do we eat?" I never knew I was so tired in my life when we got through eating. I couldn't even straighten my hands. They were so sore and... So I didn't know whether I'd make it back to camp or not. Went back to camp, and we worked till I guess about 5 o'clock, and went back and had dinner. And boy, you couldn't hit the sack quick enough. And I was sure I was almost positive that I'd never make it through the night. I thought they'd send me home in the pine box. Well, I got up the next morning, got out there, and they promoted me to, I had to split and fire for the loading donkey. And boy, was that a job. And when they opened that fire door, you had a pile of logs, these pieces that you cut even, so there's no air space between them. If you shoved one in, up, one down, and they hooked a log on there, you'd get about 3 feet off the ground and no steam. You couldn't hold your steam that way. You had to have no air space between the logs. Well, gee, that next night, my hands was so sore, I had about 40 blisters on each finger. And, well, as the days wore on, I got a little use of it. I think I could have chewed a nail into it. Well, we stayed at that camp for a month or 6 weeks, and then they relocated that camp, and they had to swing these donkey engines over deep ravines. And they had us packing water pipe, 40 feet long, in 2-inch water pipe over rough terrain. Every time you took a step, you'd sink down into the scrub ground about a foot. And, it was, if they'd have put us at that job the first day, I'd have never made it. And I worked every Sunday out there but two. One Sunday we went to Pacific Beach, the other Sunday we went to Aberdeen. And the night we went to Aberdeen, we thought we'd go up to A.J. Morley's house. It was up on a hill there, a very, very fine home there. Well, they had a lot of company up there, so we decided, no, we better not stay there. We'd go back downtown. Well, they were having a dance downtown, and first we thought we'd sleep on the lawn way down at the bottom of the hill. Well, the neighbors started raising their shades there, and it was colder than blazes, and I thought I'd freeze to death. So I said to Ted, I says, my goodness, I says, we'll have to, you guys can stay here and freeze to death. I says, I'm going downtown and get a hotel room or something like that. Well, time we got downtown was about 2 o'clock, and the train left that morning about 7 o'clock, I guess. So we went down to the railroad station there. The fellow was, colored fellow was mopping the floor at that time. We asked him if he'd come in. He was very reluctant about letting us come in, but he finally said yes, come in. So we slept on those roly-poly benches, like sleeping on a. I woke up the next morning, my back looked like a waffle. But talk about eat out there. Had an appetite like a vacuum cleaner. It wasn't anything at all to eat. You could eat a couple of steaks and maybe a dozen potatoes and stuff like that. And every night when we got back to the company hospital to go to bed, Mrs. Goodnow would say, well, did you boys get enough to eat? We'd say, no, we were starved to death. So she'd go over to the mess hall and bawl the flunkies out for this night. She says, you feed my boys here. Well, the next meal, gee, we'd get a whole pie apiece on top of everything. And I would actually be so hungry after eating all that stuff that I'd go over to the commissary and buy a whole carton of nickel Hershey bars and eat those on the way back to work in the afternoon. I weighed 151 pounds when I left Saginaw, and when I got back, I weighed 151 pounds. I used it all up. Well, after that experience, I went into the Army after that. We were supposed to go to Camp Rockford, Illinois. We got to Chicago, and the flu was so bad there. We stayed in the YMCA hotel in Chicago for 2 days, and then they shipped us down to Camp MacArthur, Waco, Texas. Well, we got down there, and gee, they had us on those marches, and I thought, well, gee, that's pretty soft, but gee, a lot of those fellas was falling over in the ditches and stuff like that, and I wondered, well, in the devil could they be so darn soft, because, gee, I thought that was a really, really great experience. And after that, I came back and went to school. I even shut down. I think I started working in the drugstore when I was about 9 months old. I worked after school and stuff like that, and before I went away to school. And that was a wonderful experience. Well, while I was going to school, I had a fraternity brother who was helping a college professor in Pineville, Kentucky, running a store, and he wanted to come back to summer school and wondered if I'd go down there and take over for him, because I was the only registered one that could do it, so I said sure. So I went down there and worked that whole summer down there, and after I got back, I got telegram after telegram. He wanted me to come down there and stay in business with him, but I thought my place was back here in Saginaw. So I came back here and worked from 7:30 in the morning till midnight about every day. And to go back, when I was young, probably about 14 or 15 years old, I had to buy my own bicycle. My dad says, if you're going to work here, you're going to equip yourself with what you need. I had to buy my own bicycle. And I remember about three times a week, I'd have to go out to the TB hospital on Y Street. There weren't any sidewalks or anything like that around there. In the wintertime, it was really rugged. I had two news sacks. And every time I went out there, I had to take 4 gallons of formaldehyde. 2 gallons in each sack, and when you couldn't ride the bike, sometimes the snow was 3 feet deep, you just pushed the bike ahead of you, and you made it, and you got back on the job. My dad, he was a stickler. You didn't do any horsing around or anything like that. It was business. He was all business. In fact, he was so much engrossed in business, he worked about 18 out of 24 hours every day of his life. Well, I remember vacation. There wasn't such a thing as a vacation. You just worked. He didn't have any vacations. If my name was Culver, I better do likewise. Well, I had a friend of mine come in the store one Saturday night about 5 minutes after nine. He says, Don, let's go to the Mecca. So I says, well, that's a fine idea. It was the wintertime. The Mecca Theater was a movie theater down the next block from the drugstore on Genesee and Jefferson. We went to Mecca. We only lived 4 blocks from the store. I got home and about 10 after 11, went to bed. I was down at the store Sunday morning at 7:30, and my dad came at noon. He looked at me and he says, now, Donald, if you don't like your job here, I would suggest you go someplace else and get a job. Well, that hit me right between the eyes. He was right. If he said that nowadays, hell, they'd haul off and shoot you probably.
What do you think about pharmacy is changing?
Oh, pharmacy is way back in the old days. There's no comparison. It's a new book. That's all. Yeah. Back in those days, you made suppositories and you made pills and stuff like that. You had no air conditioning. Sometimes it'd be so hot in the summertime, you'd have to use ice to cool the cocoa butter. Otherwise, the suppositories would melt before you could even get them shaped. And it's worse than things got better. You had better equipment to work with, and I don't know. It was, but nowadays everything is practically all prepared for you. You don't, of course, you have to know what you're doing. You got to know doses and everything like that about drugs, reactions and stuff like that. It makes it, it's a new science in itself compared with the old days.
I understand you went to the University of Michigan.
I did.
What do you think about the changes in the campus?
Oh, gee. Mrs. Culver and I went down to Ann Arbor, I think it was 2 years ago. I was one of the founders of Roll Cai Honor Pharmacy Society back in 1922, and they had a 50th anniversary, a real celebration down there. We all wore caps and gowns, and it was a real experience. We were there for a couple of days. They gave us honors and everything like that. But I was amazed at the campus. Boy, we were there this particular day. I think it was the 19th of May when they dug holes in the campus, throwing chairs and tin cans and papers and everything like that, and burning the stuff, and the papers was flying all over the triangle and stuff like that. Oh, it was disgraceful. Long-haired hippies and tents, and I don't know what the world is coming to. Nobody would have stood for it.
What was the campus like when you were going there?
Oh, it was really something. You went there to learn something. It was a privilege to have the opportunity to go to the university. It was really something. You tended to your knitting. There wasn't any ifs or ands about it. You were on your own. You did the very level best you could. I remember one year I was trying to put too much work in for the time that was allocated to it. I had two or three laboratory sessions and on top of the work, and we had trouble with the water down there. There was sulfate in the water, and that didn't make any difference. We had to do them over again. I was getting behind. I was getting a little discouraged. I wondered how I could make it. I just couldn't figure out. Well, I was going to be a loser, that was all. So I went to the dean at that time, and I told him, I says, can't I get changed one of these professors to another professor so it won't gum up my laboratory stuff, because I'm getting behind on this quantitative analysis. And he says, I'll talk with Dr. Willard and see what he says. So he says, come back in a couple of days. So I went back in a couple of days, and he says, yeah, you go see Dr. Willard. So I went down to Dr. Willard's office. It was seemed like it was about a mile down the, after he opened the door, he was sitting at the desk there, and eyes way back in his head, and I scuffed my feet and cleared my throat a couple of times, and I said, Dr. Willard, and he turned around and he said, yes. I said, did Professor Glover say anything to you about putting me in your quiz section? He said, yes, he did. Well, he says, you report here, let's see, it was either a Tuesday or Thursday, and I thought, well, good, that's fine. So I went to his first session, and he took a roll call. Culver, his first name out of the batter right at me, see, on the roll call. First question right out, right after that, after the roll call, was asked me some questions. Well, I was dumbfounded. I didn't know whether it was coming or going, see, and I couldn't answer it at all, and then he'd go to somebody else and finally get the right answer. Well, he kept after me for about a week, and I'd go home and study that night till midnight. I was going to go down with my boots on if I had to, but I was gonna do the best I could. And every day, roll call, my name was first. First question out of the box went at me. I fumbled around for two or three sessions. Then I got the rhythm of it. Boy, I was hotter than a pancake then, see. He'd ask me, and I'd give him the answer. See, I knew what it was all about then. And then he laid off me, see. He knew that he had me under his wing. And I remember when I took the final exam, he said, I had an ulcerated tooth. Gee, my jaw was swollen up about four sizes. He says, Culver, he says, you don't have to take this final exam. You're an A student. You just forget about it. No, I says, I want to take it anyway. No matter how bad my tooth feels or anything else, I'm going to take it. So I think I got 99 on the exam, and I come out with an A in the course. And I felt real good about that. So I don't know, if you have the inclination to do the very best you can, you can't lose. You got to be a winner somewhere along the line. I didn't have any money to speak of, but Ted was the greatest friend I ever had in my life. And we went down there and went into the Wharton School of Finance and Commerce, which I thought was very good, but at the end of that semester, well, Ted never went back to school, and I thought, well, my place was probably in the pharmaceutical profession. So then I enrolled at the University of Michigan and graduated from there.
What about some of the people that you met in pharmacy? You got any specific characters that you think were outstanding?
Yes, I remember Dr. Frederick Novy. He was one of the leading bacteriologists of the world. He was really something. And Moses Gomberg, he was the organic chemist who discovered trivalent carbon. And there were some wonderful professors there, Dr. Willard, Dr. Sheff, and Dr. McAlpin. They were all real qualified teachers. Teaching was a profession then that they had the finest clientele of professors that any school could have. And I think the University of Michigan, I presume they still do have, but I think they had the finest chemistry department in the world at that time because of these dedicated professors.
What was the student-professor relationship like? Was there any, or was it just mostly lectures?
It was lectures and quiz sections, and it was... you had to study. There wasn't any... It was a privilege to go there and learn. Calvert Dicer Company burned out completely March 27th, 1944. I was staying out at Birch Run at that time, and they called me at 3 o'clock in the morning, told me the store was on fire. I hadn't worked that Sunday. Mr. Dicer worked that Sunday, and it was a terrible, terrible morning, sleet and freeze, and I came right down the middle of the Dixie all the way down to the store, and it was total. You couldn't, there wasn't anything left. And by Friday, I was doing business again. We didn't have a bottle, a label, or any merchandise at all. I couldn't even find any parts of the cash register or anything, or any of the cash registers or anything. The soda fountain was hanging in the basement. The one thing that saved that was it was all made of stainless steel with a caffolite top. And, that was during the war, and at that time you had to order stuff probably 6 months ahead of time in order to have it when you wanted it. And I remember that Saturday we had 5,000 Lextron capsules come in. A lot of other merchandise came in. You couldn't find any. There wasn't anything. It was just rubble. The whole main floor had sunk into the basement. We don't know how the fire started. We probably think it was some of the refrigeration machines in the basement for the soda fountain where we kept excess stock like hams and stuff like that in freezers. And the fire department was there every day for a week putting the fire out. But Ted Morley wanted me to... He offered me the store where Granville's is now, to to start up again. I thought, well, gee, if I'm going to die, I want to die pretty close to where I was, because I'd had some of the competitors trying to switch the doctors to go to them and forget about me. And I thought, well, that was kind of dirty. And I thought, well, I'm going to stick it out. So, and the next Monday morning, we had about 50 pieces of freight come from Rexall. They knew about the fire. And I worked probably for 3 or 4 weeks. I'd work from 7:30 in the morning till maybe 4 o'clock the next morning. Then I'd go home and work ordering stuff and stuff like that till get a couple of hours sleep and go back to work. It was really rugged, but I stuck it out. And 15 months later, after the fire, we opened up again with a brand new store, new fixtures and everything else. I turned Ted Morley down on moving over there because I thought, well, if I was going to die, I wanted to be close to where I was. I got hold of Morris Lamson. He owned the Burner Building on Genesee, and he offered me that space if I wanted it, so I took that, and I thought, well, that isn't too far from the old stand. It's in the 500 block on Genesee, right by Peaches. So I moved in there. It was rather inconvenient. It was small. And well, Art McCogan, I couldn't thank him enough for what he did for me. We didn't have any fixtures or anything else. I'd take maybe 5 or 6 hours off during the day, and we'd go up through the thumb looking for fixtures. Finally ended up by he happened to think of Charlie Calvert. Charlie Calvert had some fixtures over at their place. It was Cal Wood at that time. And he loaned those fixtures to me, and we got along real well. That's all the manufacturers and distributors and everything like that were bent over backwards to get me going again.